Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Let's go back, way, way back. Let's go back to a hit song. Do we have a hit song from... No, we don't? Okay. Well, guess what? It was 20 years ago tomorrow that the Exxon Valdez oil tanker left the Alaskan shoreline black. In fact, the massive oil spill was 20 years ago tomorrow, March 24th, 1989.
President Bush dispatched two cabinet members and the Coast Guard commandant to assess the extent of the man-made disaster. But the Alaskan oil spill has already mired the president in what could prove a sticky political dilemma. Despite serious opposition from environmentalists, the president wants to open up 1.5 million acres of unspoiled coastal plain along Alaska's north slope for oil exploration and drilling. The president says the current oil disaster has not changed his mind.
No, I see no connection.
Environmentalists disagree.
The great accident that they said wouldn't happen has now happened, and we must learn from this tragic lesson.
All right, that was 20 years ago yesterday, March 24th, 1989. Nearly 11 million gallons of oil would drift as far as 470 miles. As recalled this weekend by the Anchorage Daily News, fouling beaches and fatally bathing scores of sea otters, birds, and other wildlife. A slow and ill-equipped cleanup was largely ineffective, recalls the paper. So epic it buoyed the entire Alaska economy. Even now, residual oil can be found in sediment along Prince William Sound beaches. And if you don't know Exxon by now, maybe you'll never know what it really intends for the future of energy. A long and biting article in the April issue of Condé Nast Portfolio says the world may have changed, other oil companies may have changed, but not ExxonMobil. Peter Waldman wrote the piece called Exxon versus Obama. Peter, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
You begin the piece by laying out how Exxon sees the future of energy today, much as it did in 1989 or even 1979, with oil abundant and renewables only a marginal industry. Here is a clip of the man you profile to some degree in the piece, the CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson.
We're not going to run out of oil any time in my lifetime or yours. The resource base of the globe is enormous and can support the current demand and can support the future economic growth as well.
So take us inside that corporate view, Peter. How little has Exxon's projection for its future been changing?
Well, very little. In fact, they do see a decline in oil consumption in the United States over the next 20, 25 years, but globally they still see oil or energy demand rising 1.2-1.3%, and with fossil fuels fulfilling about 60% of that demand. So they still see a robust picture for fossil fuels down the road. As far as the oil picture goes, they see plenty of oil in the ground. The complexion of that resource base is changing. It's no longer the conventional oil where they will drill deep and tap resources relatively inexpensively and actually relatively cleanly. Now they've moved on to things like Canadian tar sands and tight gas in Colorado and Wyoming and all kinds of other exotic forms of fossil fuels that require huge amounts of water and chemicals to access and, frankly, rely on a regime of lax environmental standards and very high energy prices to sustain.
And here's a stat that maybe tells us a lot right off the bat. You report in your article in Condé Nast Portfolio that last year Exxon spent $26 billion on oil and gas exploration, another $32 billion buying back its own stock, and just $4 billion on renewable energy research. What do you take from those numbers?
Well, did you say $4
billion? Oh, it's million, right?
It's million with an M. And that's derived from the fact that they give about $10 million a year to to a program at Stanford University on new forms of energy and so forth, but only about 40% of that money at Stanford is going toward renewable energy research. So it comes down to $4 million with an M per year compared to $26 billion with a B for oil and gas development.
Wow.
Basically, what that says is that Exxon is still very much an oil and gas company. They do not see themselves as a diversified energy provider as some of the other oil majors regard themselves, particularly Shell and somewhat Chevron. BP certainly sees itself that way. These other companies have fairly large investments in the tens to hundreds of millions, and in some cases over $1 billion, in things like solar and biomass and other areas of non-fossil fuel development, whereas Exxon is pretty confined to the fossil fuels.
So Portfolio is a business magazine. And you frame this less in terms of whether the Earth is sustainable with current Exxon practices, which is, I think, the more usual discussion in the media, but whether Exxon's business model is sustainable. Is that seen as a question among oil experts?
Well, less so today. I mean, remember, the horizon of the business community tends to be, you know, quarters of a year or perhaps 1 or 2 years. So nobody is discounting Exxon's prospects in the very near future. They still have the largest reserves of any big private oil major. And, you know, they still can pump and sell quite a bit of oil. And the higher prices go, the bigger their margins are. However, it's beyond that time frame. Let's say in the 5-plus year, perhaps 10-plus year time frame, when indeed President Obama and many of the other world leaders and citizens of the world are successful in transforming our energy economy onto a more renewable basis, Exxon, with this blind side, with its refusal to really invest in renewables, could be caught somewhat high and dry, and that's the concern. That said, they have over $30 billion of cash in the bank, and presumably if there's a breakthrough in alternative energy, they can swoop in and buy it up, and they're certainly capable of doing that.
Now, the people you quote in your article questioning ExxonMobil's long-term viability are not exactly Greenpeace. You quote Fidel Geit, an influential oil analyst from Oppenheimer and Company, who says Exxon epitomizes the peak oil theory. That's the theory that says the world will literally begin to run short on oil in the not-too-distant future. There just isn't that much oil left to develop. It's unproven, but Exxon epitomizes peak oil theory because of this complete reliance on it for its future. You also have IBM predicting the gas-powered automobile will lose 30% of its current market share. And we also want to bring in one of your sources, someone who you quote in the article, who we've called to come on with us, and she is Neva Rockefeller Goodwin, a descendant of John D. Rockefeller, who founded Standard Oil, the ancestor of Exxon. She is a development economist at Tufts University and a dissident shareholder of Exxon itself. And Ms. Rockefeller Goodwin, thank you very much for coming on WNYC today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about your relationship to the company.
Well, I'm a shareholder. And, of course, there is a sense of family relationship, since it was my great-grandfather who founded Standard Oil, and Exxon is the largest and most noticeable descendant of that company.
Mm-hmm. And I gather you confronted, according to Peter's article, you confronted the CEO, Rex Tillerson, at a board meeting about the business model?
Well, I submitted a shareholder resolution asking them to look into some of the facts about some of their assumptions about where their growth is going to come from. They assume that their growth is going to come from increased demand from developing countries, but there's a contradiction here, because climate change is going to hit the developing countries first and hardest and worst, and is going to really cause their economies to go down and down and down. And therefore, the assumption that their demand for oil will go up, which is based on an assumption of economic growth, simply is internally inconsistent.
Now, leaving the current banking crisis and worldwide recession aside, are you arguing that the economic effects of global warming would counteract all those other trends of growth we've been seeing. When we talk about the developing world, we're talking primarily about China and India in terms of the vast amount of population there. And, you know, part of the last summer when we saw the price of oil going so high, the reason that was given all over the place was the unstoppable march of the Chinese middle class. Do you think that a few degrees warmer temperature would really be enough to turn that from a net positive into a net negative?
They seem to think so. They are investing much more than is generally recognized in policies and technologies to reduce global warming, to reduce their own contributions to it. You know, a few degrees of temperature rise sounds pretty mild and innocent, but in fact the result is potentially ever-increasing storm violence, rising sea levels, serious medical problems, lack of fresh water, lack of food. It's quite an economic disaster.
Here's another clip of the CEO, Rex Tillerson. Like the last clip, this is from a CNBC interview in May of 2007. He was asked if the bottom line is all about making money for shareholders.
Well, that's without question. That's why I'm in the position I'm in, is to provide a shareholder value to those people who invest in our company, the 2.5 million individuals, the millions of people who own our company through their mutual funds, their pension plans. So continuing to create shareholder value is our reason for being.
So he obviously thinks he's on the right track for shareholder value. Are there many other dissident shareholders like yourself who think the company is going to run itself into the ground by relying too much on old fossil fuels?
Yes, indeed. And some of Exxon's largest shareholders take this position. There are a number of very, very large pension funds in California, New York, Connecticut, all over the country, who have joined in really trying hard to promote the kind of shareholder resolution that I put forth and that several other people did, and also have on their own been writing to Exxon asking if they can have meetings with the board to discuss these issues. It's astonishing for a company that says that it cares about its shareholders that they have absolutely refused to have any meeting of any board member with even their very largest shareholders. And when they have meetings between shareholders and representatives of management, management preaches and doesn't listen.
Neva Rockefeller Goodwin, she is co-director of the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University, a descendant of John D. Rockefeller, the founder of Exxon forerunner Standard Oil, and a dissident shareholder, I guess both for business reasons and environmental reasons, on in the shareholder community of Exxon. Is your main concern, before you go and we continue with Peter Waldman, because I see that you are with an environmental institute, is your main concern really the profitability of Exxon or to save the environment?
I don't see a difference really between them, in the sense that if climate change causes the kind of economic disruption that I can anticipate, the business environment will go crashing downward for all businesses. And the business which has been estimated to have, that is, Exxon has been estimated to have created 5% of the global warming gases that are now in the atmosphere, is going to face such a reputation risk, such a backlash from consumers and government policymakers. They are in a very dangerous position, and it is not a position that makes shareholders happy. So the combination of environmental risk and economic risk seems inextricably intertwined.
All right. Neva Rockefeller Goodwin, thank you for coming on with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still with us is Peter Waldman, author of a report in the April Condé Nast Portfolio magazine on ExxonMobil's unchanging business model. And Peter, the title of your article is Exxon versus Obama. And the president has certainly not been shy about taking on Exxon. And I want to play two clips of Obama and listen to how his tune has changed with respect to Exxon and vilifying Exxon in particular. First, this is from an Obama event in 2006, before he was officially a candidate for president.
The easiest thing in the world is to look at ExxonMobil's profits last quarter and say, these folks are making $36 billion in one quarter, and the CEO is making $500 million, and gas prices are high, and we're getting gouged. That may be sufficient because it does describe the degree to which the powerful have made out like bandits over the last several years. That may be sufficient to get us through this election, but after the election, people then are going to say, okay, smart guy, what are we going to do about energy?
All right, so don't just vilify the wealthy oil companies, said Obama in 2006. But then this is what he was saying by February of 2008 on the campaign trail.
I know that it won't be easy to change our energy policy. ExxonMobil made $11 billion last quarter. They don't want to give those profits up easily.
So, Peter Waldman, that's a very interesting set of contrasting clips to me, because he says in the first one that the real challenge is to change energy policy, and that the profits of the oil companies are kind of incidental to the status quo. He says in the second one that the energy companies are the barrier to change because they won't want to give up those profits easily. So, it's a bit of a nuance, but it really was a change in tone and a change in where he was coming from, do you think?
Well, I think it was the reflection of the heat of battle. I mean, he was running for president in the second one in a very tight campaign against Hillary Clinton, a primary campaign against Hillary Clinton, and he was referring to these corporate predators at a time when gas prices were soaring last year during both the primary and general election campaigns, and he used Exxon as a sort of whipping post. I think the nuance is going to come now, and he sort of referred to it in the first clip from 2006 when he basically says, well, once you're in office, what do you do? And now they do have a plan and an agenda, and I think he's proceeding somewhat methodically down that road. Certainly the financial and economic crises have impeded the pace at which he would have liked to pursue energy policy changes and legislation, but he is going down that road. The best example is the Recovery Act that was passed by Congress a few weeks ago, in which there is lots and lots of subsidy money for weatherization, for electric cars, for more research, tax breaks for people who invest in solar power, all kinds of things that will hopefully stoke demand for renewable power. He still has some big nuts to crack, and the biggest by far is what you do about greenhouse gas emissions. And I say that not because the main focal point is the climate, although that obviously is a driving force, but because without some way of taxing carbon or putting a price on carbon emissions, you don't have the sort of levelizing effect to renewable energy sources, meaning that the more you put a price on carbon, the higher the prices go for fossil fuels, including gasoline, and therefore the more competitive solar and wind and all the other energy sources become. So that's his next big issue, and he cannot jumpstart renewables without putting a price on carbon.
So before you go, one other policy issue here with respect to putting a price on carbon, because you write in your piece that Exxon is reading the handwriting on the wall about global warming policy change and expressing its preference for a straight-up tax on carbon emissions rather than the cap-and-trade system that the president and Congress seem to favor. And I wonder if it's because cap-and-trade looks like a market solution, and then it's up to Exxon to pass on the higher cost of living within those limits. With the tax, the government looks more like the bad guy and like they're imposing the higher cost of oil on the consumer. Do you think that's why Exxon prefers a carbon tax, which, by the way, Al Gore also favors, over cap and trade?
Yes, but I think it's also even simpler than that. And you mentioned Al Gore. They suggested early in the Bill Clinton era to put a tax on carbon, and it went absolutely nowhere and was probably one of the biggest reasons the Gingrich Congress came into power in 1994 in that midterm election. And that was the Americans don't want to be taxed, particularly on gasoline, but they don't want to see their energy bills go up precipitously like that. So I think what you're looking at here is Exxon reading the tea leaves saying, hey, we can't be dinosaurs about this. We can't cover our eyes about the concerns about climate change and fossil fuels. We need to be somewhat proactive. They've chosen to come out in support of a carbon tax because, at least in my view, it's politically implausible. Congress is not going to pass something of this magnitude that's called a tax. So they're saying, hey, let's support a tax. Congress will never do it, and maybe we'll get a few more years of inaction.
Well, if Peter Waldman's article is right in the new Condé Nast portfolio, Exxon is still deciding to look away from reality, not only in terms of damage to the environment, but its own business future. Interesting piece, Peter. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from what you said, I know you've gotten over me. It'll never be the way it used to be.
A hit from 1989, the time of the Exxon Valdez spill, 20 years ago tomorrow.